Welcome to the Kick Sugar Coach podcast. Join me each week as I interview experts who will share the science of sugar, sugar addiction, and different approaches to recovery. We hope to empower you with the information and inspiration, insights, and strategies you need to break up with sugar and fall in love with healthy whole foods so you can prevent and reverse chronic disease, lose weight, boost your mood and energy. Feel free to go to my website for details on my coaching programs and to access free resources, kicksugarcoach.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kick Sugar Coach podcast. I'm here today with Brian Baumol. Am I saying that right?
You are. First attempt out of the gate. You got it perfect.
Good. And he is a registered psychotherapist out of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and he has expertise in weight management, food addiction, eating disorders, bulimia, the whole spectrum, the whole tangled yarn. And he also has training in, just a little bit more about that, bulimia, binge eating disorder, food addiction. And he also has his own journey, his own story of recovery, including having gained and lost 100 pounds, but has kept it off over a decade. So
yes.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Florence. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you're one of us and you've turned around to help others get free. So why don't we start with your story? Hit us up with some highlights of your own struggles with bulimia, binge eating, exercise, and food addiction.
Yeah, sure. So I can tell you that perhaps differently than many other people, I was the thin kid. If you will, in grade 9, my school decided to take everyone's fat caliper readings and then post the lowest by age and grade, just the top 10, the lowest of them. So they didn't shame anyone who was heavy, but they posted, for grade 9 boys, I had the second lowest fat caliper reading. Out of anyone there, the guy above me was a school star track and field guy. But what that did, and all the comments I received before from my family, you're like a toothpick, you've got a hollow leg, don't go out in the wind, you'll get blown away. All of that led to a couple of things that began to cement disordered eating behavior. First of all, thinness became part of my identity. Second thing was, as a young child, it's very confusing when people comment on your body. You know, you're 6 years old, you're running around playing tag and hide and go seek, or whatever. And people are going, oh my God, he's so skinny. You don't know how to interpret that. And I want to generalize those out because that same situation can happen to someone who's overweight. Oh my God, they're so overweight. And in their teenage years, obesity becomes a part of who they are. One thing that we'll talk about later is that eating disorders, though binge eating may seem very different than bulimia, that may seem very different than restriction or anorexia, the psychopathology across all of them is almost identical. So if weight is a part of your identity and your self-esteem, whether that weight is heavy or thin, you are in line for any eating disorder. If comments about your weight, whether you're heavy or thin, come in at a very young age, that it's the comments that set you up, not necessarily the body size. So that began to set me up for disordered eating. Some other things that began to happen. I think I experienced adult life's disappointments fairly early on in young adulthood life. I didn't like the university I was at. I didn't like the program I was at. Got mediocre grades in university. Just wanted to get out as soon as possible. And then I started out in business and marketing, and it was okay, to be honest with you. But it wasn't what I wanted to do. I was good at it. In some cases, I was very good at it. It wasn't what I wanted to do. Sitting and grinding numbers is not my idea of fun. Working in a corporate environment is not my idea of fun. But that's where I was sort of groomed towards. So what did I do? I began to turn to food for comfort. And because I thought I would be thin, because I thought I was, just built that way, I thought I could eat whatever I wanted to. And for a while I could. But then, of course, metabolism slows and everything like that, and you start putting on weight. And for me, I guess because I had been thin, I had reverse body dysmorphia, if you can call it that. I don't know if it's a term or not. I wouldn't see how heavy I was getting, per se. I never used a scale before. So, though, that sort of started triggering the issues with food and the issues with body as well. I had a severe enough case of scoliosis that I had to get surgery on my back, a steel rod put in. Even till this day, I don't know how to stand properly. I don't know what it's like to have my feet on the ground. I was sort of athletic, and that got interrupted as well. So the relationship with my body, too, was primed for disordered, primed for disordered eating, if you will. I also had low self-esteem, and I won't get it. I think I could just say my self-esteem was low, not necessarily because of these things, but for other reasons. So when you combine that in recipe for disordered eating. I was able to gain and lose 100 or lose and then regain 100 pounds through what I now know as exercise bulimia. I was working out twice a day in secret and probably eating about 1,000 calories a day during that period. And what kicked in was all the comments I was getting. Again, the comments from other people. And it was like, Brian, you look great. You look fantastic. And what do I do? What do I do? How can I? I'm already thin. What can I do to top that? Which is a low self-esteem thought. And the other thing, too, was like this low self-esteem kicked in another way. I used to count the number of comments I would get from people. And if those comments went down from one event to another, I thought I had to exercise more or eat less. Or some people would say, you're still going to the gym. And I'm like, oh my God, do they think I've gained weight? I better start doing something. So all of these thoughts mushed together created exercise bulimia, which is unsustainable. And then I binge all the way up. And 2012, when I finally said I'm going to take responsibility for my life, I said to myself, I have to do this differently. In 2003, 2004, 2005 is when I had exercise bulimia. And in 2012, I said, what do I have to do differently? And by this point, I trained as a psychotherapist. And I allowed myself to trust myself. And so I said, what do I have to do differently? And the answer came back from a deep place in my brain. And it said, you have to exercise less. And then my rational brain kicked in. Less? Obviously, the last time didn't work. Why don't you say you have to exercise more? This makes no sense. So we battled it out for a little bit. I said, no, you're working out twice a day in secret. That's wrong. As a therapist, you ask a client if they drink alcohol in secret. Do you gamble? There is something fundamentally wrong with that. So I said, okay, lesson learned. I got to go lighter. Other things. I could not let any excess weight that I couldn't lose derail me. Right? So when I had exercise bulimia, it was, I wanted to get the perfect body. I'm just not built for that. And I said, you know what? I cannot let an excess 5, 10, 15, 20 pounds derail any effort. In other words, I learned to accept my body at that point in time. And then eating. And here's where we could talk a little bit about abstinence versus moderation. I said for me, I had to moderate because I knew I was a disordered eater. I said, you know what? I have to moderate a little bit. And I'm going to monitor this very, very carefully. But I guess another way of saying it more generally, I had to develop a sane relationship with food, not one that was, you know, with a diet or with anything outside of what I wanted. So with that began a very slow journey to where I am now. And during that journey, I learned to accept my body even more as it was. And then I decided to get into the field. But that gives you a brief sense of my history.
Interesting. Couple questions. So it doesn't sound, since you sound like you're a moderator, it doesn't sound that you fall on the food addiction spectrum. Is that correct?
I would say that's correct. But so first of all, I do recognize food addiction. I do treat food addiction. I assess for food addiction. I believe in food addiction. And I had one experience with food addiction that changed my life around this, and which is worthwhile explaining. Actually, before I explain my incident with it, when I decided to move my therapy practice towards weight management, I started to reach out to people in Toronto who were doing similar things. And the people I happened to reach out to, the two names that stand out, one is Tony Vassallo and the other one is Dr. Vera Tarman. I reached out to, not by accident, but they were just on top of my Google search when I typed in weight loss Toronto or something like that. So I reached out to them. They were very warm and welcoming. And of course, they take an addictive approach. And my initial response was, oh, these guys are crazy. But the thing is, if you know Tony and if you know Vera, they're really nice, credible, ethical, down-to-earth, salt-of-the-earth people. And so I said to myself, they're not, that because of all these good traits, I have to start listening to them. So I did, and that's how I got exposed to food addiction and got into it, and it grew from there. So then I began to believe, you know, that some people are food addicts, some people are binge eaters. As I was learning my practice, I began to read about the differences in the two. But now food addiction's planted in my head. Now I'll come to my experience with it. In about 2015, about 3 years after I had maintained my, or 3 years after I started my weight loss and changed my diet, I felt it was time to eliminate sugar. I had gradually reduced over about 3 years, and I said, okay, time for me to cut it out. And so I did. I cut it out on November 1st, 2015, I believe. Yeah, 2015. And 6 or 7 weeks after November 1st come holiday parties. So I went to a holiday party and I thought, okay, I'm just going to eat whatever I want to, sweets, sugar, whatever. Didn't really think anything of it. I ate at this holiday party one chocolate gold coin. So I had not eaten sugar for about 6 or 7 weeks. I eat one chocolate coin. And I felt my mind as if it was taken over by an alien, like literally. Don't want people to think I'm crazy, or like it was just taken over. And I had what's called a shift in visual perspective. It's called forced perspective. What was close to me became blurry, and what was far became clear. And then must find sugar was the thought. And the shortest distance between me and a source of sugar, in between it, was someone who had trouble walking at the time. And my vision was to tackle that person out of the way so that I could get sugar as fast as I could. Now, I didn't do that. I mean, you know, I don't even, most addicts, not all, but most addicts would not do that, engage in that behavior. So I didn't. But for 20 minutes, 15 to 20, I was gripped in this hijacking, if you will. And when I came back, I said two things. Number one, that was one of the most scary experiences I've ever had in my life. And number two, this is something that is completely different than a craving. I probably had, like many people, if you count up all the cravings you have over your life, I was like in my late 40s, tens of thousands of cravings, probably tens of thousands. This was not just the most intense. This was on a completely different scale, completely different. And when I told this story to Tony and his group and other people as I was building my practice, anyone who was a food addict said, Brian, this is what I go through 24/7. This is my life. This is my relationship with sugar. This is the war that goes on in my head. So from that moment on, I now had an empathetic relationship with people who had food addiction. So that's a little bit about how I began to recognize food addiction.
That is an amazing story. So it begs the question, two things. Do you think your abstinence, your abstaining from the consumption of sugar, and your experiment 6 or 7 weeks later set you up for that kind of hijacking of your brain? Like, what actually happened there?
Yeah.
And then the second part is, today, did you go back to being abstinent, or have you learned to moderate sugar?
So it did set me up, but I don't know the chemical processes. Now, I don't know if you're asking this because there are some eating disorder people who say that addiction is caused by abstinence of sugar. And if you just moderate, everything's going to be fine. I don't believe that. I don't believe that. And we'll come back. Remind me about that. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that later. But, you know, I think I had an addictive experience. That's all. Did it set me up? Sure. But I believe food addiction stands alone from these things. I think that people who, now I'll get into a little more psychology, but I think people who are eating disordered, if they abstain for a while, it's the thoughts around food, thoughts around guilt, the thoughts around themselves that may drive them back. And then maybe all or nothing thinking if they have something. I think people who are food addicts have to deal with that demon that I had every day of my, or they have to deal with that demon that I had for 20 minutes. They have to deal with it every day of their lives in order to abstain. And once they start again, it's just like a stove lighting up, or a car starting 0 to 100 in a second. Whereas I think those with eating disorders, if you probe them carefully enough, you could trace the thoughts that are there. So it may have set me up, but I do not believe eating disorder people when they say, if you moderate, that's the answer and you'll avoid food addiction. The second question is, do I moderate now? Yes, I do. I do. As I say, I don't recommend that for everyone. I, in my practice, and maybe this is where we'll go next, I assess everyone for disordered eating or food addiction. Sometimes I have to do 2 or 3 sessions with people just to figure out which is which, or if they're both, to be honest with you, because you can have both operating. You could have someone with a food addiction who has body image issues that could drive disordered eating as well. So it gets very complex in terms of who has what, but I do assess, and then I tell them where I think the assessment, where my assessment is, and then treat appropriately.
Got it. So why, in your opinion, and in your perspective on this, why did you have this experience of addiction where you never had it before and you've not had it since?
I wish I knew. I honestly wish I don't have an answer to that. I think it may have been because I did get rid of sugar. And I often wonder, could I get rid of it? I think for me, I would be playing with fire if I tried to do that, because I've been working at this, like my own relationship with food, for 10 years with moderation, with the exception of that 6-week period. So I don't want to mess with anything. But I do believe that I'm someone who, if I abstain for a while, will ferociously bounce back. But when we talk about abstinence, there are many people for whom abstinence works. I've seen it. It works very well for people who are food addicts or volume addicts, or any kind of addictions. Clients of mine who've just gotten rid of carbs and gluten, et cetera, and their cravings or their addictive tendencies just stop. So getting the assessment is very important, I would say. Getting the right assessment is very important. I can't answer why it happened to me.
It's so interesting, because it definitely seems to be evidence that the deprivation, you know, leads to the binges, to that addictive, like, brain on fire must have. I think I'll tackle that person in front of me. And so it begs the question, if your brain always potentially had that, but right now you're sort of dripping, you're just giving it enough that it's placated.
Right. And, you know, I've had clients who I know are food addicts who moderate, and I have clients who I know are binge eaters who can eliminate. You've got to be very careful. I've had clients with binge eating disorder and a history of restriction who say to me, can you please label me a food addict so I can eliminate this stuff? I'm like, no, not gonna do that. You know, we have to sort of figure this through a little bit. And we have to look out for your sanity, first of all. Sometimes you can ask someone, point blank, what solution is going to have the most impact on your sanity? Moderation or elimination? And why not believe them?
Right. And I'm sure there's many, many people who know they're on the addiction spectrum, the food addiction, sugar addiction spectrum. Yeah. And they just, in their heart of hearts, can't get their head wrapped around, or their heart wrapped around, elimination. But they've lost hope, because they know they're on the addiction spectrum, that they can moderate. And so I'd like to talk a bit more about that. Like, how can people successfully do that? Maybe they'll never be ready to abstain, right? To embrace abstinence as a tool. And so what are some tips and suggestions you might have to help people do what you do with people who are addicted but are moderating?
Right. So first of all, what I tell people is, I say, we've got to experiment for a couple of weeks, like what I did for 6 or 7 weeks or 2 months or so. Like, let's start out of the gate and figure out what works for you. So people who may be addicted, who want to try moderation, or who are successful with moderation, first of all, there are a couple of cognitive things that people have to realize. They're not going to lose weight as fast. They're playing with fire. What they really, you know, they have to drop any hope of having a rail thin body. Like most people, virtually all people, have to do that anyhow. But you have to tell these people, you are really playing with fire and running a risk here. So your expectations have to be managed. And then I question them about whether their self-esteem is ready to handle this, because they're really going to be living on the edge, I think, on a day-to-day basis. And it can, you know, for severe enough food addicts, I've heard people say things like, someone put a turkey sandwich in the office refrigerator the floor down from me, and all I can do is think about that sandwich. Are you prepared to live like that on a daily basis where you are walking that line? That's a self-esteem line, because you're really putting food first. You're not putting your mental health first. You're not necessarily putting other activities first. But if you're going to try and moderate like that, you're really still putting food first. So there's a lot that I would ask someone before they're willing to give that a shot. The other thing too is that there are, as you know, there are different levels of food addiction. And I say, I want to give a plug for research. There's very little research on food addiction. So I wonder whether a mild food addict can moderate a little bit. We don't know we have our own clinical theories. We don't know if people can, there's no research on it. So I would say someone who's a mild food addict may be more successful with moderation, but anyone who I would say is moderate or severe, not a chance.
Right. It's just so much harder, even though it's heartbreaking and there's grief and loss and it feels impossible, right? That once it's done, it's like, oh, well, why didn't I do this sooner?
And that's where I work. Grief and loss with people. And what often comes up when addicts have been successful for about, I don't know, 4 to 6 months or certainly a while, they realize that they have emotions like sadness, anger that they can't deal with. They never knew how to deal with them. So there's got to be education and education around that. The other thing too that I'm becoming more fond of, perhaps in my old age as a therapist, is to tell people life is hard and you can't get around that. And beating an addiction may be one of the hardest things that has to be done, and not many people worldwide have to do it. I will grant you, you may have a little bit harder time than other people, but life is hard. And if you want to beat this, you're going to have to face up to it. You're going to have to face it. You have to face the addiction head on. And you know, we get into personifying the addiction. Dragon, devil come up a fair bit. I'm sure you've heard that before. Angel, devil on the shoulder. Get into facing all of that and characterizing and depersonalizing the addiction. But it's hard no matter which way you look at it.
Absolutely. Talk to us a little bit about the difference between binge eating mm-hmm. disorder and food addiction.
Yeah. So I will say it's another place where more research is needed. What I'm about to tell you is my own homebrew observations and based on listening to podcasts such as yours, Dr. Tarman and Tony Vassallo and Sandra Elia, who are all food addiction experts, as well as taking numerous courses in eating disorders as well. So but I would say get more research, but here's how I conceptualize the difference between the two of them. First of all, actually, before I get that, there's the Yale food addiction scale, which is rudimentary, I think. And I think that there, and first of all, use it. Like, I'm not going to tell a clinician not to use it, but there are many things on that scale that correspond to binge eating as well. And that's the problem. The symptoms between the two significantly overlap. Eating faster than normal, thinking about food all the time, eating past full, dissociation, eating in secret are all considered symptoms of both. So you can't, in my view at least, you can't rely on those to be conclusive. Sometimes I have to go back into past history. So sometimes I can luck out where someone's dieting history, if I can use that term, dieting. And I will say, okay, what made you come off, or what made you stop that diet? And they said, well, one day I had a chocolate sundae and that's it. It was over. It was done. Or I literally had a handful of M&Ms and boom, it was done. Sometimes you can luck out in that way with the diet history. Another thing too is I think food addiction, just in my experience, has a much earlier onset than disordered eating. So people who are not necessarily, their body type can be whatever, but they just say, I was eating so much more. Many children are addicted to candy. I'm not looking necessarily for a compulsion to eat candy at any young age, as much as I'm looking for, I was eating so much more than other people at that point in time. So age and onset are a bit of a difference. Dieting history is a bit of is a bit of a difference. The compulsion part, I say to people, when you wake up, is your first thought, where is my chocolate bar? Or is your first thought, all right, I'm going to check my messages, I'm going to go to the washroom, I'm going to brush my teeth, what's going on for you? But people who say my first thought is candy, or where can I get my fix? Another check in the food addiction box. I ask people if they know of anyone who's been addicted to any other substances at all, friend, family member. And if they say yes, I say, can you tell me, is your relationship with food similar to their addictive relationship? People are pretty good with knowing that, I've found. And then I guess the final thing that I look for is something called whether there's, I guess, low self-esteem. Low self-esteem, there's a psychological term, egosyntonic or ego dystonic. And what those mean is when someone has low self-esteem that is egosyntonic or inside their personality or inside their ego, they really think they're an awful person. Really, truly bad to the core. An example I used before was if someone with an eating disorder, went to heaven and was judged, the only thing that the eating disorder person would want to be judged on is their eating. Doesn't make a difference if they fix the environment. Doesn't make a difference if they've cured a disease. Doesn't make a difference. They will be a bad person because they ate a piece of cake on their birthday. That's the egosyntonic nature. What I found is that people with eating disorders tend to really feel bad to the core. And people who have addictions will have guilt around the addiction, will have shame around the addiction, will feel bad about themselves, will feel that they're ruining their lives because of the addiction, will feel that they're ruining their family because of the addiction, putting their health on the line, all of that. But then when I say, are you fundamentally a bad person because of this? At the very least, they could say, maybe. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. It could kind of go which way the wind blows. So, and when I mentioned this to Vera Tarman, she said there's probably something to that as well. But so I think people with disordered eating and eating disorders, they feel rotten to the core.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Because if you'd asked me that question, I'd say, no, I'm a good person. Fundamentally, I know I'm a good person. Right. I score very high on sugar addiction, food addiction.
Yeah.
But I also binged. I was a binge eater too, right? But I binge ate only after I started the dieting deprivation, right? Like that only came on after I started in my early 20s to try and not eat so much junk food. And then I started to binge. I wouldn't say there was evidence of that prior to.
Right. Yeah. You got it. So, I mean, if there are any researchers listening that want to look look at that. I'm more than happy. But to me, that is the big thing. And when I treat people who have food addiction, you know, the corollary of all this is I say to them, this is not your fault. This is really not your fault. There's a chemical reaction. I don't really know what it is, but there's the chemical reaction that creates such an overpowering want in you that you just can't break. And so I say to them, you know, this is not your, and they're often so relieved to hear that. Again, not because they're an awful, awful person, but because they're like, oh, I've been thinking about that maybe I was, and now to hear I'm not is a good thing. Whereas with someone with a really ingrained eating disorder, if you tell them it's not your their fault, they're likely not to come back.
Really?
What do you mean it's not my fault? Of course, who puts the food in my mouth? Who drives?
Wow. Who
drives through the drive? It's me. I'm telling you, it's me.
Wow.
So I take an entirely different approach with disordered eaters. And I don't blame them. I want to make clear, I don't blame them at all for what they're going through. But I think if you say to them, it's not your fault, you're going to get a lot of resistance back. And I can work with that as a therapist. I don't know if I want to, especially in the first couple of sessions with people. But I just tend to avoid the saying to people that it's not your fault, and that we need to sort of look at this part of you that feels bad and moderate that a little bit.
Oh, that's so interesting. I've heard in some of the addiction literature, I forget the name of the book. It was someone I interviewed last year, and he was saying there was three P's, and one of them was is that he felt addiction was a form of self-punishment. And I could not get it. Like, I don't think I binge eat or I struggle with food or I go off the deep end with Doritos because I'm trying to punish myself. But it sounds like maybe people who are more on the eating disordered end of the spectrum have a self-hatred and like they're blaming and bashing, and like maybe that might come into that a bit.
It does. I mean, I probably with addicts as well, there's sort of the shame spiral or the shame cycle. Hmm. But I do believe that people with disordered eating and eating disorders do want to hurt themselves a little bit more. We in Gestalt terminology, we call it retroflexion or turned around anger, turned around sadness. So what should be put out into the environment is just turned around into the self. And this literally is eating one's emotions, but to an extreme, to a really, really extreme level. And the thing is, people can do this unconsciously. It's not like they rage and then eat. It's just, you know, they'll think, I'm so miserable. My life is so miserable. What's the point? Might as well just eat. And then they struggle. I am hurting myself. And if I am hurting myself, that makes me a bad person. And if I'm going to die and I'm married and I've got kids and I've got this and I'm going to die, what kind of father am I? What kind of person am I? Eat.
Right. It's like, it's confirmation. It's proof. It's like they use it as evidence against themselves. Like, right? Like a good person wouldn't behave this way. A good person wouldn't put their life on the line when they've got kids. And
now we get more into these similarities between perhaps disordered eating thoughts and eating disorders and depressive thoughts as well. Not to say that there's a relationship. Conceptually, there probably is. There's also conceptually a relationship to anxiety. But yes, the proof. I am a bad person. Like, that's the thing. But Brian, I am a bad person because I did eat this. I am a bad person because I spent my family's last $20 on a Big Mac meal when I really should have bought blueberries and stuff like that. This does make me an awful, awful person. So they're always looking for proof and demonstrating.
It's a heartbreaking.
Demonstrating that proof.
It's heartbreaking to hear this. And I don't think I really fully appreciated that piece. I mean, I know there's always self-loathing and there's such a shattering of self-respect when you every Monday you make a new promise that you're going to do this and you're going to eat better and you're going to move more. And you, you know, by Thursday or by that afternoon, you're off the rails. And of course, that's damaging to self-respect. But this deeper ontological sense of badness is quite a... So talk to me a little bit about how, for people who have both, right? They've got a binge eating, they've got disordered eating, and they've got addiction. So they've got this double whammy. How would you work with someone like that? Like, what would be your approach?
Yeah, very good. Very, very good question. So first of all, I have to resolve the issues with body and self-esteem. That I think is fundamental. Unless your eating puts them at significant risk. DBT said it targets three different behaviors, self-harm being the first, above all else, therapy is not going to work on a client that's dead. Now DBT was designed for people with borderline personality and people who are, so it puts but you can target your interventions a little bit. So unless there's severe diabetes to work with, or a physician saying this has to happen, or a dietitian saying this has to happen, I will focus on body image first and self-esteem, and get those under control, and then focus on whether we eliminate or whether we abstain. So it would be the psychological factors first, as opposed to the eating. And then I would say, look, we got to figure this out now. Let's try elimination for 2 months, or let's try moderation for 2 months, and see where that takes us, and see what you're comfortable with. Let's have both on the table.
Got it. Fascinating. What an interesting place to start. Wow. And I would assume that you would start with moderation first, because no one would want to be set up for the chocolate coin. Right.
The chocolate coin thing. Exactly.
Exactly. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. You don't want that. That's it. Exactly. The only reason I think I survived that was because I had trained as a therapist, and you learn to be very introspective of yourself. You learn to say, oh my gosh, this really, really strong thing that I'm feeling is very interesting to live through. And it's sort of like Mr. Spock, because you're half Vulcan and half human. And so you could see the emotions going on in his head. Leonard Nimoy played that very well. You could see it, but he would be very stoic on the outside. Mm-hmm. So that's the only way I think I survived it. And you're right, I wouldn't want to put someone in that. So yeah, try moderation first.
Right.
If it doesn't work, try elimination.
Right. I love that. So back to that moment when you've eaten the chocolate gold coin, something has activated in your brain. You're all of a sudden like, where can I get sugar? Somebody's in your way. You didn't tackle them down, which is great. But did you get to sugar? And what happened? Like, were you able to, was that Spock part of you able to abort this?
It did. For 20 minutes, for maybe the first 5 minutes, I thought that I would have to grab onto a relative and say, take me to a hospital, or just sit with me because something's happening and I don't know what it is.
Wow.
It said sugar. It said, eat this. But it wasn't a craving. And maybe this is it. I'm just thinking about this now. If I had eaten it, I don't know if it would have quieted it down. It may have, like oxygen to a flame, it may have grown.
Guaranteed. Yeah.
So I did the right thing.
Yes.
Instinctively, I did the right thing by avoiding it. Yes. So what happened was after about the 20 minutes of not eating it, I was like, okay, I'm okay. And then I just went back to eating normally, and the chocolate or whatever I ate, whatever it was, had no impact on me either way. But yes, I'm just thinking about this now. If I did eat it, it might have made that flame that's mind-blowing.
That would have gasoline on a fire, for sure. It would have been a binge. Who knows when you would have stopped. Right. And then the next day, right. But you aborted it so quick. So let's go there. What advice would you give somebody in the midst of an addictive episode? Like, how can they do what you did?
Very, very, very good question. So first of all, I talk to people a lot. I mean, I don't know if addiction and an addictive compulsion is the same as dissociation. I'm still not sure.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay. I would agree with that. I would agree with that. I don't think so. So what I do with them is I say to them, you have to realize when this devil is operating, when this dragon is operating, and personify it with them is the first thing I do. And then I say, you have to step out of yourself and just sidestep yourself and look at yourself from 20,000 feet. What I have done before, and it's worked somewhat well, not perfectly, is I say, if you have the wherewithal, videotape yourself. Just take your phone out and videotape yourself either in the addictive throes or while you're eating. Because if you're completely unaware of it, if you're completely taken over, let's look at that process. Let's stare it down and let's look at what's going on. So, you know, the other thing too would be to call someone. Sometimes if the therapeutic relationship was right, they could call or message me. I don't mind. I don't necessarily mind that as long as it's not reliant and they understand I'm not an emergency service, but they could call me during the throes of it. The other thing too is continue to journal. That doesn't work when you're in the throes of an addiction. But I would say those are three or four tactics. Step aside, videotape, call someone. And if you give in to it and if it does expand it, eventually it will end. It may take a week. It may even take 2 weeks. I have had clients before who have slipped up. They were doing well for a month, slipped up, and it was another month relapse. But you know what? They got back on it. And to this day, I talked to that client last week, I think. Client is about 4 or 5 months off of their addictive substance. So if you have to give into it, you really can start tomorrow. That's a whole other podcast, perhaps, you know, how to recover from
right.
an addictive episode. But those are some things I would say to people.
Brilliant. Brilliant, Brian. I really love that taping part. Like, because it forces you to train the meta mind to be the observer. And when you're looking at yourself binge eating, and someone, I've said to my husband or my sister or something, hey, film me while I go off the deep end here. And then I look at it and go, right. Right. That allows me to imagine that I am watching this behavior that's just, you know, hijacked me. And how much easier it would be in the moment, I can imagine, after the fact, to be able to move into meta mind and observe. Last question. I know we're almost at the top of the hour. I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a bit about how important it is to address food addiction prior to bariatric surgery.
Very, very, very good question. First of all, I will always state I'm not a surgeon. There are if you're going through a publicly funded system, there are many people along the way who can help you. But from the small proportion of or small sample of people that I have in my practice, and now my practice is actually growing in bariatric clients. I do see, over the course of a year, I would probably see anywhere from 50 to 100. That's still a drop in the bucket. Anyhow, from that point of view, what I have found is that if you don't address your problems with food, including food addiction, it will come back. It may address volume addiction in theory, right? In theory, it may address it. But if you are addicted to your trigger foods, my view is it does nothing, because I've heard clients time and time again, my behaviors come back after 6 months. I still have a craving for chocolate. And I keep giving into it. And some say, I'm shocked. I knew I should have addressed this before. I thought maybe the surgery would work. And it hasn't for them. So it is absolutely critical in my view to address your issues with food prior to the surgery, to really, really give it a chance.
Right. Got it. And then maybe the surgery won't even be needed. Wouldn't that be ideal?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it gets into someone's personal decision about whether they're in a position to lose the weight, if they want to lose, even do they want, like, okay, I've addressed the food addiction. Do I really want to lose the weight? But are they in the position to do it, and so on and so forth? But yes, certainly if you repair your relationship with food, one very possible outcome, and this is what happened with me, you don't need the surgery. I didn't need it.
Right. Got it. Brian, any final words before we wrap up today?
I am thrilled to have been here. I wish that people who were in the eating disorder camp would recognize food addiction for what it is. As a therapist, I believe that about 3/4 of my job is just listening to people, like listening differently and listening better. The remaining quarter is technique and so on and so forth. But if you just listen, you're doing 3/4 of your job. And I believe that any therapist or anyone whose job it is to listen, if they listen carefully enough, will realize that some of their problem or some of their patients' problems with eating fall into the food addiction category, or they don't fall into the binge or the disorder category. If you listen carefully enough, and that's your job. So you should be doing your job and therefore recognizing food addiction.
Oh my gosh, that's brilliant. And you know what? One final thing to tie in there is that the number of therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists that aren't even trained in either. They're not even listening for either. And they don't realize what a role it can play in mental health issues, right? So they're treating well this leaky, you know, the leaky bucket. Like it's complicating the progress they're making with just the psychological and forgetting this physiological food piece.
So, yeah, and I'll comment on that very, very, very quickly. I think there's a stat, and we have to find the origin for it, but it's something like 6% of Canadian psychiatrists, and I've heard this from psychologists as well, the area that they want more education in or feel least qualified to address are eating disorders. And I guess, you know, food addiction, not that they're the same, but, you know, just addressing eating issues. One of the things, like, I will spend an entire first session sorting through whether someone has an eating disorder or a food addiction. Now, for me, I'm trying to figure out how to treat them. But for them, they've never spent an hour talking to a compassionate professional about any of their food issues because the professionals don't know and haven't been trained on how to ask it. And then combining that with the empathetic therapy stance, what was it like to be like this? How did you manage all of this when your parents took the food away from you or told you to eat everything on your plate? What was that like? I'm assessing, but equally, they've never done that before. And it does take a little bit of training to do that. But once you get the training, a couple months, maybe once you get it, then you ask about it and you build that open relationship about food.
And in the context of a healing empathic therapeutic dynamic, as opposed to the diet mentality dynamic, mm-hmm. right? Where, you need to eat more fruits and vegetables, or, you know, you should exercise more, or are you counting calories? I mean, that does not work for anybody, let alone people with disordered eating and food addiction. So I love that your point is that listening for it and then doing it in the context of therapy as opposed to diet mentality.
I do have to say this, and then we can wrap it up. But I'm taking a course through Dalhousie University called DCOM, and it's a diploma in, I can't remember what the C is, but DCOM, Diploma in Obesity Management. And it's offered by Michael Vallis and Tiffany Shepherd, who are both health psychologists there. I'm the only therapist in the group, but the remainder of the individuals are physicians, nutritionists, nurses, occupational therapists. And what they are teaching is sort of therapy for for dieticians and for people who will say count calories. And what we are learning in this course, what all of us are learning, is sit with ambivalence, do motivational interviewing, know that your client may not be ready for this.
Changes.
Give them time to talk. Go through a proper mind map of brainstorming. Ask, listen, summarize, and invite. So that's the four things we've learned there. And invite is really interesting. Invite says, can we actually have a discussion around calorie counting? Or can we have a discussion around what I think may work? And it gives people the option of saying, no, I don't want to do that, or I want something else. So instead of infantilizing a patient or insulting them.
Yes, it's happened. I'm sure you have had clients who've talked about that too.
So I want to give a plug to that program because there are germs of it growing in the wider community, and I hope it grows out so that providers do have the time to be more empathetic, to just listen, because people with food issues, no one listens to them.
Right, they don't. And the last thing they need is another bloody diet, right? And pressure to follow a diet doesn't work. Let me just put in a shameless plug for where you can reach Brian. You can reach him at TorontoWeightManagement.com, and I'll put a link in the podcast. Brian, thank you. This was precious time. I really appreciated our conversation today.
My pleasure, Florence. I look forward to hearing the podcast. I've been a regular listener now, and I'm promoting it to everyone that I know.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. All right.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning in this week. If you would like more interviews, more information, and more inspiration on how to break up with sugar, go to my YouTube channel, Kick Sugar Coach, or my website, kicksugarcoach.com. See you next week.